In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
And you don't care about anything but making money. There will be a giant sucking sound going south.
That is a giant sucking sound as we're talking presidential politics and so forth. Three people running, four people running. That's a prescription for Hillary Clinton to be president of the United States. Eight more years of the Clintons, that's what we need. 16 years of Clinton's total. John Kass, Chicago Way, with Kristen McQuarrie and Jeff Carlin. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Kristen, you haven't been focused on the presidential and the big picture and the giant sucking sound and Bill Kristol and all that. You've been focused on actually how our pocketbooks will be assaulted by a horde of White Walkers led by the White Walker himself, Michael Madigan. What the heck is going on in our state where they put out a $7 billion budget shortfall and then play political games? What is going on? What am I supposed to do? Run for the hills, Jeff? Are we supposed to run?
I don't know. Can we just get drunk and pretend we live in another state? It's just every time you think that the dysfunction has reached a new low, they drop the floor. And that's what happened yesterday. It was, you know, they wanted to take time off in January, February, and March. You know, we pay them, by the way, between $70,000 and $110,000 a year for these part-time jobs, January through May. And then they pretty much took the first 3 months off because we had a primary in March, and they all wanted to
get ready. Mike has to elect his people.
And Mike has to elect his people. I'm sure the Republicans appreciated the time off, too. But so then it's always this race to midnight on May 31st. After May 31st, if they pass a spending bill, they need a supermajority instead of a simple majority. So it changes the whole dynamic. And of course, midnight passes, no budget. It's really the only job that they have to do down there is pass a state budget, and they couldn't do it.
Here's where I think, not your characterization, but generally the characterization is unfair. And I'm going to be a little partisan here. Yeah, okay, because I wrote about Rauner when he started. I kind of introduced him to my readers and the Tribune readers, and I supported the guy because we're living in crap, and we had to change something. But here's what I see. When we say dysfunction, it kind of applies to every, like, they're all pox on all their houses. When what I see, and tell me if I'm wrong, are two little leprechauns, Mike Madigan and his mini-me, you know, the Jimmy DeLeo puppet, Johnny Cullerton, and basically they are the ones who are pushing this system for politics and political gain in November as opposed to taking care of business, cutting back their priorities, telling their own constituents, hey, man, we can't fund these pensions the way we did. All that. It's just kind of pushing it on, pushing it to November so they can have a little soundbite and a mailing and maintain power for Madigan. Yes or no?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, but shame on us for even expecting anything different. After all these years, why do I wake up on mornings like this, you know, agitated? Because, of course, they kick the can. And, of course, everything is about November. They don't give a shit about what is going on in the state. They are ruining people's lives. Universities are closing. Social service providers are shutting their doors. People who have addictions, autistic children, all the vulnerable people in the state who rely on state government, they are the ones who suffer when we don't have a state budget because that pie that's already small keeps shrinking, and they have to wait in line for all of these people to get paid before them. It's just, it's sickening to me. And then at the same time, I have to just take a step back and realize I keep setting the expectation way too high. They've never been policy driven, Madigan and Cullerton, especially Madigan. They are driven by maintaining their supermajorities, and so they don't want their members to take any tough votes because they want them to coast in November.
But the more we borrow, the longer we push these decisions down the road, the more it costs me.
Yes,
as a taxpayer.
Exactly.
In other words, Mike Madigan, you're taking care of your politics, but as you push this stuff, kick the can down the road, the cost of borrowing the money goes up. So you're making me pay more.
Right.
And where is it? I mean, outside the Chicago Tribune, my newspaper that I'm very proud of, and your columnist and editorial board member, I don't see a stand being made. I see Rauner saying stuff. I see the Tribune standing up. But I don't see... What bothers me is I don't see the other responsible analysts and publications and media. They're all kind of like they don't want to piss Madigan off.
I don't even know if they think about it that much. You know, before I started opinion writing, when I was just news writing for the news side, I sort of didn't allow myself to have opinions where I was getting agitated either way. But I'll tell you one thing that happens.
I'll give a mutsa now. Stick that hand out. Nah, mi sosis fisadore. Go on.
But one of the things that I think happens, especially in covering politics, is this whole group think mentality. And I hear my own colleagues repeating the Democratic talking points.
Steve Brown.
You know, like, oh, well, we can't possibly pass, you know, because my point is...
Because the government can't afford a tax cut or whatever they say.
Whatever. Like, right. They keep characterizing Rauner's turnaround agenda as this drastic anti-union pro-business agenda. Actually, if you do the homework... What he is asking for are reasonable, tiny changes to help local mayors when they're doing collective bargaining, to give them some wiggle room with prevailing wage, not taking away collective bargaining rights for wages and health care and all of that. Tiny little nibble around the edges changes because our state labor law has become so top-heavy, favoring unions over management. And he wants to make a few changes to that, along with term limits, redistricting, things that are wildly popular with average voters. But you won't know that by reading the regular newspapers because everybody just spews this.
The anti-union
agenda that he's trying to break the unions, and it's absolutely false.
So in other words, the truth is, Jeff Carlin, that it seems that Madigan's language police or Madigan's shapeshifters or shamans have basically won the debate by characterizing it and having Madigan's thoughts characterized in the general narrative of the news in Illinois, except for the Tribune editorial page and maybe a columnist who wants to give that White Walker a big mutza as soon as I get back to my typewriter. But they seem to have won the shaping of the narrative.
They do. They absolutely have. I mean, there's just no question that you don't see. I mean, I've written a few editorials, but it's not like one editorial is going to do the trick. But where I've really tried to explain, you know, the state's labor laws are too heavy on labor, and mayors are begging for some relief because it costs local taxpayers more when you have to pay somebody $75 for a small, tiny public works project. You know, so he's trying to get some wiggle room. So if you have a public works project that's small and by the way, it helps minority trades. It helps the immigrant population when you are allowed to break free a little bit from these handcuffs that prevailing wage laws insist. And by the way, by the end of the day on Tuesday, Governor Rauner was ready to do a stopgap budget, which is probably what they're going to do just to get them through 6 months. And there was nothing in his turnaround agenda in the stopgap budget. And they still said no, Madigan and Cullerton. So if you have any question about, you know, that their whole philosophy is gridlock, there were some pivotal moments yesterday that just exposed them for what they are. Gridlock.
You've covered Springfield for a long time. I want you to explain to the listeners of the Chicago Way how formally White Walker? No. How formally a Speaker of the House is selected by his members? Do they do it by recording their vote? So I, Will Guzzardi, or I pick another decent, you know, I think he's decent, Democrat, mm-hmm. puts my name to the vote that I'm, so John Cass, never would happen in a million years, vote for Mike Madigan for Speaker, so it's recorded?
No, of course not.
What happens?
Well, what I've heard has happened on a pretty routine basis. So this happens every 2 years. A legislative general assembly is a 2-year stretch. He will actually, on election night, Mike Madigan, call up his members, congratulate them, even the newbies, and ask for their support for Speaker. That on the spot, on the phone, on election night, after he has helped fund them, after his lawyers have helped kick opponents off the ballot, after he's helped do all the walking pieces for them. And they'll sort of pledge their support over the phone. And then when they get sworn in January, when they all hold up their hands and they take an oath.
To uphold the Constitution.
Yes, it's
to care about the taxpayers of the people.
Supposedly.
Of Illinois.
Right. And by the way, Article 8 of the Illinois Constitution passed a balanced budget.
Right. So after they do all
so
that.
So they do. They raise their hand and then they say, all in favor of Mike Madigan as House Speaker, please say aye. Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. Mike Madigan gets another term as Speaker.
And
that's
that,
it.
And that's how it's done. Yes. So you don't know. So then the Democrats who support Mike Madigan, and none of them don't, but they're not recorded as having done so. So they have a little wiggle room. Here's my prescription for all of you out there, as long as I have this column. Come in November, all of you who are on Madigan's side are on my crap list, and here's why. We cannot afford it. The state is going to hell. The taxpayers are leaving and running. Business is crap. We cannot afford this bossism anymore. Anymore. And the only way, I heard a famed analyst the other day on the radio talking about, well, you can't elect, you can't go into Madigan's district and defeat him. No, but what will happen is if 10 or 15 Democrats don't make it in the House, what's the supermajority?
Oh, they're up to, they have maybe 15 or 16 more members
okay.
of the Republicans.
So then there's 18 or 19 that will be I don't know if it'll work, but I'm going to let people know who they are, what they have to do. Because if you vote, it could have been, if we were in Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Alaska, where there's some Republican machines, I would be the same way.
Right.
I don't like machine work.
You don't like one-party rule because it doesn't work. Exactly.
We'll see what happens. People are leaving, and Christian McCurry gets upset, and I give them boots on.
I'm so mad at myself for getting upset.
No, don't get upset. You should get upset.
Take a cleansing breath.
I'd like to go back on something, John. You did say that none of the legislators care about us like they should, and I don't care if they care about me or not. I want them to work for me, and that's what I think is Kristen's point. Is
what does work mean?
Work means do something.
Do a budget.
Do something that
doesn't,
helps.
How about this? Make a budget that's not $7 billion in the red so that you can accuse the other guy of not caring for the poor. How's that? Because you know what? What about all of us who pay?
Mm-hmm.
We all pay. I'm tired of it.
And the thing that has been driving me nuts is this whole concept of they're playing politics with Rauner, and God love him, God hate him, whatever. He was elected. He was elected as a change, and they've stood in his way. We've already had the election. There's no more choice
Sheldon
here.
Sheldon Silver? Yeah.
Give it up. You need to work with what you're given.
Maybe one of you brought this up, but remember when Obama was first elected and Mitch McConnell, Republican leader in the Senate, maybe he was minority leader at the time, came out immediately and said, my number one goal is to make sure that he's a one-term president. I mean, publicly just saying, I have no interest in doing any policy changes with
right.
you, working with you, compromising with you, listening to you, nothing that could possibly move the country forward. My number one goal is for you to be a one-termer. And that is exactly what is happening in Springfield to the opposite.
So where are all the journalists who were so upset about Mitch McConnell applying
exactly.
that same thing?
Exactly.
Look, there's like three or four of us in this whole state. And you're
it is. It's a lonely, it's
you,
a small
me,
caucus.
Right, small caucus. And I'd like Jeff to weigh in because we have our own view here.
Sure.
Steve Brown, who I never see written about, I'd love to see that.
He's a spokesman for Mike Madigan.
I would recommend a three-part series from each, although sometimes I have to give them credit for where they did some of it
mm-hmm.
on Steve Brown. I'd like to know if you're a journalist and you're trying to book Mike Madigan on WGN,
mm-hmm.
do you always nod when Steve Brown talks?
No.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're saying. Absolutely.
Not that you would do it.
But
Roe or Anna.
Right.
I just get this sense, right? People want to go along.
Yeah, it's like a chance for the bite at the apple of Mike Madigan because he is so elusive. I mean, this is the guy who's been hounded in his place of work and at his home, and people just ignore people.
Yeah,
exactly. And it is that elusiveness. You want that because nobody talks to him, and you kind of jump a little bit when they say jump, but at the same time, you know, it's not worth it.
I've had it. I'm not with him personally.
Right.
Personally, tell you the truth, I like Mike Madigan. Personally, I think Mike Madigan is like the most disciplined, most cunning, most hardworking and intelligent political operative I've ever seen in the state. I've never seen anyone better at what he does, and I admire his competence. I just think he's totally wrong, and he's screwing up the state for his own power.
Right.
What's stop it?
I know. They don't even understand it. I mean, last night President Cullerton was sort of justifying the fact that they were leaving town without a budget because it's no big deal. We're going to keep working on it. No, it is a big deal. That is your one job. And it also bothers me that we will go bananas. We will go to the mat. We will take numerous votes over the pension clause in the Illinois Constitution and upholding it and debating it.
Oh, yeah,
but we will completely ignore other parts of the Constitution if it doesn't suit us, meaning, you know, pass a balanced budget.
Oh, you know what, though? I think that maybe if we had an attorney general. See, the attorney general, not only does the attorney general might want to look at corruption once in a while, but also is that person that reads the law and tells us what, this is the Constitution, this is what.
Sure, you're violating
the Constitution. I haven't heard anything.
It's been awfully
quiet. Why is that?
It's been so quiet. I don't know. Let's figure this out. Let's think about this. Okay.
Let's see.
See, the attorney general could, you know, maybe sue or at least use her bully puppet to kind of knock him around a little bit.
Hers, because it's a woman who's
hers.
An attorney general.
Well, she's the attorney general.
What's
she's supposed
again?
To defend the Constitution. Let me think.
Starts with an M, right?
What is it? Laura?
Yeah.
Lisa. Lisa Madigan.
That's
it's Lisa Madigan.
You're reading too much Christian McQuarrie.
Hi-yo.
That was a great moment.
Speaking of Christian McQuarrie, since I know we got to kind of cut her loose because she has to go back to informing the masses. John, how was your anniversary? What did you do?
Kristen, it was really nice.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't take that trip. We're going to take that trip. The boys came in. We had some time. I always try to keep the family away from social media with me, usually because of stuff that happened when the boys were little and they were threatened by thugs. But so I kind of discouraged them from even getting it. Like, what are people saying about dad and all that? You know what I mean?
Yes.
I just kind of just ignored it and let it go away. But we sat at the kitchen table, and I read some of the comments that people made on Facebook about that column I wrote about Betty. And it's just nice. So we went to the jewelry store. I ordered the ring.
You did. You're getting a wedding band?
Yeah, I'm getting a wedding band.
I'm so glad.
Over at Reichman's on 95th Street, talked to Otis.
Okay, sure.
And, we're getting the wedding band, and Betty's getting something. But she said, I really want you to wear it. And I said, I really want to have it.
Very nice. I'm glad.
I love it.
Very sweet. It's so important here we are going on and on about the legislature. So unimportant compared to, you know, our home life and just
your
taking
children,
a moment.
Your husband,
yes, and to, like, just take, I mean, your column really just made, I think, everybody just stop and take stock, you know, as to what's really important. And it's certainly not the first part of this conversation, although it does animate me because I feel like it's hurting the little guy. That's the motivation, I think, for all of us with the frustration with state government is that it hurts people. And, you know,
the priorities are the people that need the help the most.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And there are, like you said, autistic children. There's Helping Hands. There's groups like that need the help. Okay. All right. So let's help them. Why can't we just sit down and do it like a normal conversation? No. We have to have evil people. We have to demonize people. So why? So Mike Madigan can be the boss and someday install his, I almost said insipid, but I won't, daughter into the mix as governor? Are you kidding me? What kind of state is this where we're run by bosses? Oh, I get it. This is the Chicago way, is it not?
It was a long day, and we were goofing around.
Right,
didn't realize
you're off
we were
camera doing your lines.
Doing my lines, exactly. So I thought it'd be funny if I did bop. In Dothraki.
Right. Now, what is bop in Dothraki?
So, bop it, and that fine doing, dot it.
I don't think it was
and then you and...
That's so... I can't stress how much less catchy that is.
Yeah, thank you.
With us right now, we have one of my heroes, David Peterson, the creator of many languages on Game of Thrones, in particular Dothraki, unless I have a nerdgasm now, Valyrian and so forth. He has two books out. One is a book on Dothraki, the language of the barbarian horse lords. He has come out with another, The Art of Language Invention, From Horse Lords to Dark Elves. Have to begin this by welcoming you to the Chicago Way and by saying Matu Madwan.
Oh, well, Ritzas. I don't think I recognize that one.
Matu Madwan, I thought, was hello in Dothraki. Good morning, or so forth.
Oh, maybe Matu Madwan?
Matu Madwan, sorry. Pardon me.
All good.
The creation of a language. You built a language, Dothraki in this case, from Game of Thrones, by focusing on, several dozen words that George R. R. Martin used in his novels, correct?
Yeah, because the initial goal was to make it look like the words that George R. R. Martin had created had sprung from a larger language, because we were, we're trying to honor his creation, so they didn't want me just creating something brand new. So what I had to do was start with those words and then basically reverse engineer the language that they could have come from. So that by the time that I was finished, you wouldn't be able to tell that, he had created his words first.
When you create a language out of whole cloth, you also, I'm assuming, consider the culture that gives birth to it. And therefore, like in the nomadic fictional, but who doesn't want to wear leather pants and have a braid and ride a horse? In this fictional Dothraki barbarian world, I'm told there are many words for what is important to them. So since they're killers or raiders, I would assume the thrusts of and chopping motions of that sword blade have very, have many different words for the same thing, correct?
I'd say most languages have things like that. I'd say languages where sword play is kind of an art. So, like French, for example, or English for that matter. In this case, I had an idea where the type of sword thrust you were making would be tied to a specific animal. I kind of like the idea. So I actually derived the names of sword thrusts from the names of animals, and just went with it from there. I don't know if I ever got to use them on the show, though.
And they're animals that are consistent with this Dothraki grassland, or did you just pull them?
No. Consistent insofar as I can make it.
Of course.
The interesting thing is that at least reading the books for Game of Thrones, there is a grand variety of animals that the Dothraki come into contact with. But of course, George R. R. Martin is the ultimate source of canon. So if he says that there's elephants and tigers and lions.
And platypus
and chimera
in the mud, right.
Yeah, if they're all there, it's like, all right, they're all there then.
The use of, or the a language that has many words for one thing or similar things. For example, I'm thinking of the language I grew up speaking, Greek, as a child. If you look at the language at a culture that has many words for a similar thing, but they're slightly varied a little bit, does that allow for the mind of the people that speak the language to expand and embrace varied and challenging ideas? And I'm wondering how that applies to the Dothraki, who seem to be quite singular in purpose. Conquer what is best in life, to drive your enemies before you, to conquer them, to hear the lamentations of their women, or something like that. And I wonder, what is the language of Dothraki? Does it allow for philosophy, for the arts, or is it the art of war alone?
Any language, you can discuss anything. I mean, at least language is created for humans anyway. We're all humans. We all have the capacity to discuss the same thing. The only minor differences you see are that you have words for physical objects that are around you, and you don't for things that you don't. Once you get to the modern era, we have words for absolutely everything because we're connected with every culture and every area on the planet now. But when it comes to kind of what you see on the screen for Dothraki, you get a very limited view of what their culture is like, because you only see the Dothraki in a certain number of very, truth be told, bizarre circumstances. You see a lot of war, a lot of infighting. And then, you know, after the first season, you don't see much of the Dothraki at all. You see a small subject section of them following Daenerys along to other places. Because of that, after all, I mean, the show is Game of Thrones. It's not an examination of the lives of the Dothraki people.
I'm waiting for that. Right.
Yeah. So because of that, you know, you don't really get the full sense of what their lives are like through the force of this narrative. We see only a very small percentage of it.
So, David, I was wondering, when you are creating these languages, do you start with, like, rules? Like, you set yourself up a grid work for, like, hey, you know, people talk to each other, they're going to use this sort of tense or that sort of tense, or do you do it situationally for what you're reading in, like, a George R. R. Martin books or in a script? Do you see, like, a scene, and it's like, well, I'll start with this scene, I'll write this scene, and then I'll use those rules that I wrote for that scene and move on?
No, the problem is, like, if you have a scene of any length, you're going to end up using so much of the grammar of a language. The only time you don't do that is really when you have these little scenes that are contrived in teach yourself books, you know, when you're learning a language. I mean, there they have control over what grammar they're using in every sentence, and so they can make sure you don't see advanced stuff. But if you're just talking normally, which presumably if you drop into a random scene in somebody's life, you use grammar from all over the place. So it kind of all needs to be there before you do any serious translation. And I consider, you know, serious translation to be anything above a short sentence. You pretty much need the whole thing. And so I get that done ahead of time so that by the time I have to translate anything, you know, a full scene, one sentence, multiple scenes, I'm not sitting there trying to come up with tenses, deciding I need a new tense because of something that's going to the scene. That would just be a disaster.
So in the scene, now that it's passed, I guess, spoiler alert, but it passed several weeks ago, the scene where Daenerys Targaryen is in the meeting hall with these Dothraki barbarians, and they are telling her what they are about to do to her before she has her revenge upon them. Is their dialogue scripted by the writer, and then you translate it for them? Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's it. So they write it all and then just send it to me and have me translate.
You ever say, wait a minute now, because I'm sure writers would love this. Wait a minute, a Dothraki would never say so-and-so or such-and-so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. But I don't think I've had to say that since season 2 or 3. They're pretty good with it. I'll make a note about it. And often they'll change it if it makes sense. But of course, I can always have the liberty of the translator, shall we say, or if you look at it as a viewer of the show, the other way around. Since technically, I guess, if there are subtitles in the fictional world, the subtitles are translating what they're saying, what I would be writing. So that means that sometimes what you see in the subtitles is not exactly what has been translated, but it at least gets the sense of it.
And can you talk a little bit about the process of getting the actors to be able to know the language? I saw one of the actors over the weekend talking about how that they get like a raw script where it's not translated, apparently, and then they kind of baby step their way up to the taping where they've got to memorize all of it. And are they learning it, do you think? And how does that process go?
I don't think that they learn it, no. And I know this after meeting with a number of actors and hearing kind of a similar story. I think what they do is once they have my MP3 recording and the translation, I think they figure out how they want to say something. And they'll do that using the recording and also using the word-for-word gloss I give them so that they know which word means what. And then once they know how they want to say it, they just memorize it by rote. And at that point, they don't need to remember what it means anymore. I mean, they know what's going on in the scene and everything,
right?
But they won't know word for word what they're saying anymore. It's almost like song lyrics in a different language at that point. You can just do it, and then that's what they do. They get on there on the day of filming, and then they just perform it exactly the way they remembered it.
We're speaking with David Peterson, linguist from Berkeley, and the author of an amazing new book, The Art of Language Invention, From Horse Lords to Dark Elves, The Words Behind Word Building. I'm just fascinated by this whole business of conlangers. And what is a conlanger?
Conlang is short for constructed language. And so conlanger is somebody who makes constructed languages. And that's the word that the community came up with, and so it's what we use now.
So you talk about how, you know, you seem enamored or look up to certain languages. Are there any languages that you think, you know, that are the, you know, most beautiful or most complex, and that you think are just blown away by that they were ever even created in the first place?
Besides Chicago,
right? Besides Chicago.
Well, when it comes to just liking a language, I've always loved Hawaiian. Hawaiian is my favorite. But for language complexity, all languages are equally complex. They just put their complexity in different places. So it's always a trade-off between, you know, having to learn, say, more forms of a word, more verb conjugations, more noun declensions, versus having to learn more words. In English, we are on the other side of this. It's like our verbs are very simple compared to something like Spanish, but you have to learn a whole bunch of different auxiliaries, and you have to learn how they all fit together, and you have to learn, you know, all these different sentence structures. So it's not like English's verb system is easier to use and easier to learn. It just puts that complexity elsewhere. It pushes it off to somewhere else. When you're looking at language complexity and thinking about, well, you know, how difficult is it to learn this, you have to think about it coming from your standpoint as a language user. So certain things are going to be much easier for English speakers to learn than would be for Japanese speakers to learn, because our languages are so different. So, like, for an English speaker, I think some of the most complex things I've seen are, like, the Georgian verb system from the Georgian language, just monstrously, monstrously complex and perverse compared to English verbs, if that's what you're used to. That's very difficult. And so is sort of strongly polysynthetic languages like Inuktitut, or any of the languages in that spectrum. So Sikitun, Marmiut, any of those guys. That's really an alien way of doing a language compared to English. And so it's going to be very, very difficult to learn. Those two are probably two of the things that really, really blew my mind. It's really strange. And then the grammar of Arabic was one where I found it, and it was like coming home. I'd never seen a language like that or imagined a language could work like that, but it made intuitive sense to me, and I really enjoyed it.
I want to ask, how many languages, real and created, or traditional rather, and created, do you yourself speak?
Not many. I mean, I can speak English and Spanish, but after that, there's a sharp, sharp drop off. Because what I would do is I'd study as many different languages as possible, rather than study one to fluency. So, like, you know, the languages I've studied in the classroom. You know, Arabic, Russian, Esperanto, French, German, and American Sign Language. And Middle Egyptian, I guess, but we didn't learn to speak that. We just learned to read and write the hieroglyphs. Those are going to be the ones that I'm best at, but then it's not like I kept up with them trying to gain fluency, and then I moved on to others.
And you're creating other languages while you're still working on those. For example, High Valyrian, Low Valyrian. This What is Shivisis? Sorry.
Shivisis, that is the one I created for the Dark Elves in Thor the Dark World. It was a fun project. I think that the languages I create have the same relationship to them as the languages I study in books. So, like, you know, recently that I've started doing this again. I've studied, you know, Hinti, Attic Greek, Ancient Greek, Akkadian, Japanese. I'm doing Finnish right now. I think I have the same relationship with those languages as I do with the ones I create, where I know the grammar very, very well, but it's not like I can just speak it. I need to actually practice with a fluent speaker of the language and, you know, have back and forth there to gain any confidence in it. But there are no fluent speakers of the languages I create, so.
Clearly there aren't any Dothraki around for you to model it, but when you created or shaped Dothraki, you had a certain sound, I think, in mind, right, from the few words that Martin had put down in his books.
Right.
But there's a sort of guttural, tribal tone to the Dothraki language, as opposed to, why couldn't they have been more lyrical and musical? Why would that not have fit? Because of our American or Western understanding of what we think barbarians sound like?
Well, it is quite musical and lyrical, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's really, when it comes to languages and how we think of them, it really is a matter of cultural stereotyping.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we have ideas based on which cultures speak which real world languages and how those languages sound and how different they are from ours. We have stereotypes that we've come up with about what is a harsh language and what is a beautiful language.
Arabic, for example.
And it's totally arbitrary.
Right.
There's nothing in the sounds that make them beautiful or make them harsh. It's just in the preconceived notions of the beholders. So,
Exactly.
Dothraki sounds very nice to me. It's got a very nice rhythm. Something that's very pleasing in my ear. But usually when it comes to listeners, it's just the presence or absence of the sound kh, which tells you if a language is harsh or not. Often it's no more complex than that.
When I was a little boy watching movies or television, I would see American Native Americans depicted on the big screen, usually played by a Greek or Italian or Jewish guy or Spaniard, and they would grunt and make nonsense sounds as if they were actually speaking language. And now we've come to the point where in good productions, entire languages are created with grammar and rules and different dialects within those and different styles of speaking to suggest nobility or low birth or whatever, however it may call it. It's really been a change in the last 30 years or so.
Yeah, I think that we've seen that change with natural languages too, because you can't get away with that anymore. You can't get away with, like, you know, taking, you know, an Italian and the Mexican, you know, putting feathers on them and saying they're Native Americans and have them make up whatever they want. And I'm happy for that change, you know, not just with created languages, but with natural languages too. You know, I remember, this is a big moment for me. I remember seeing the movie Atanarjuat, which translates as The Fast Runner. And this is a language that had an entirely Native cast. Was written by natives and was done in the Inuktitut language. That was the first time I'd ever heard it. You know, I'd seen it. I'd seen examples of it, you know, mainly in linguistics, you know, because we looked at it. But I never actually heard it. And it absolutely blew me away, because it was something that was very interesting to me when I was listening to this language. Is like, you know how often when you're hearing a foreign language, it sounds really fast, especially if you understand it a little bit and are trying to follow along and be like, oh, slow down, I didn't catch that word. This is a language, when I heard it, even as somebody who'd never heard it before, I got the distinct impression that it was spoken very, very slowly. Like, I could catch every single syllable. It had a great rhythm, you know, but it wasn't like it was going too fast. I mean, but it's not like that. It's not like that helps you understand it. It's still a completely different language. But it was just, I'd never heard anything like it. And, you know, the entire movie was in Inuktitut with subtitles. And I thought it was just so much better because of that.
I've never seen it. I'm sorry I haven't. What is the name of it again?
You find it if you just look up The Fast Runner.
I shall.
It was a Canadian movie. But it was about, It was about a Native myth that they had made into a movie. And it was done all in the Native language. And it's just so striking.
I'm getting the signal, but two questions I have to ask you. Number one, how can one, are these languages copyrighted? Like, what is this Klingon copyright thing? I mean, can you actually copyright a language that you create and then present?
You know, right now people think you can, but I think that's fundamentally misunderstanding what a language is. I mean, if you think about, just think about English right now and ask yourself a question, what is it? Like, where is it in the world? This physical object, can you find it? It's like, and what does it even mean, what is it? Like, you think about the little regional differences between somebody from Chicago who speaks English and somebody from Southern California who speaks English. Now compare that to somebody who's learned English in India, you know, as one of their first languages. And all of these things are supposed to be the same thing. Like, the second you try to pin down a language, the only time you can pin down a language is when it's dead. It's not a thing. It can't be copyrighted. It's basically an idea. And the same goes for a created language. I mean, it's like if you create a dictionary and a reference grammar and you publish that, you can absolutely copyright that book, but you can't copyright the language. Language isn't a thing. It's really just a bizarre way of behaving, I guess. That's all that the languages that we speak are. It's just a unique way of kind of moving your organs around to produce sounds, put those sounds into strings and to produce strings of words that we give meaning to, I guess. It's not something that can be copyrighted at all, David, at least in my opinion.
David Peterson, creator of languages, Game of Thrones, author of books. Where can people learn more about you and this business of creating languages? And I'm sure there are many parents who will be, kids will decide, this will be my career. I will become a language creator. And you'll have created all sorts of difficulties for parents paying for college tuition.
Well, you can find me at my website, artoflanguageinvention.com. There's a link to my YouTube page where I go into more detail about specific aspects of language creation. But if you have general questions about language creation, what it is, who does it, what other created languages there are out there on the internet and elsewhere, you can go to the Language Creation Society's homepage, which is conlang.org. conlang.org.
Mr. Peterson, thanks so much for all your work and your precision in thinking. It's just been a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, my pleasure as well. Thank you so much.
Bye.